This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Staying safe is not easy on highway construction crews, and Row Construction Supervisor Tad Myers says one job is key.
Flagging is probably one of the most underestimated positions. You usually try to keep the same people on it a lot.
Listen to Ryan Denham's report on construction zone safety. Plus, Mayor Terry Renner joins us in studio to talk about the latest defeat of the effort to pass a welcoming city ordinance and the potential for new development in town. And there's reaction to the nomination of federal Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Illinois State University professor Tom McClure talks over the impact that will have. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington City Council is moving ahead with plans to find a developer for a big vacant lot just north of downtown. GLT's Ryan Dunham is in studio with Mayor Terry Renner to recap what happened at last night's meeting and what didn't.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
We'll cover what Alderman did do here in a minute, but yesterday was notable for what didn't happen. Hours before a special session that was expected to include a vote on the Welcoming City Immigration Ordinance, you canceled that meeting. Why did you do that?
Well, we did have to kind of go back and forth in the previous weekend of whether or not to decide to do that. It wasn't an obvious decision, but it was quite clear that the ordinance was going to go down and go down big. Several aldermen had said that they had changed their mind on it. And so given that, that's one reason. The other thing is that there are some things that the mayor certainly can do. And those are the things that I did and acted on in a positive way yesterday by issuing a proclamation going as far as I could, saying that Bloomington is a welcoming place, calling on our faith-based groups and others to help get involved, calling on the police chief and the police review board to work on specific protocol in dealing with ICE. And Chief Wheeler, of course, in subsequent interviews, has made it quite clear that he's not only willing to do that, but was going to do that anyway in terms of examining those ideas so that people feel free to report a crime if they've been a victim of a crime or if they see something, that we don't do ICE's work for them. And I think those things are important. And when I listened to Charlotte Alvarez, part of her interview yesterday on GLT, I think that many of those very same concerns that she expressed were the same kinds of things that Chief Wheeler was willing to do. And so as we move forward kind of on the micro level on the ground with the police review board, I think we can accomplish much of what the coalition was looking for. And I was able to do kind of at the macro level without the power of an ordinance, but it is a proclamation, which is part of the legal record of the city, declaring Bloomington to be a welcoming city, a diverse city. We embrace diversity, and that we are a nation and a community of immigrants, and that that is a source of strength, and all of the other things that followed with that proclamation. And then again, calling on Chief Wheeler to deal with a lot of the implementation of these issues and work with the police review board.
And I want to get and spend some time talking about the recommendations that you made to the police chief, but we'll take one step back here and talk about the Keep Families Together Coalition. So this is a coalition that has lobbied for more than a year to get an ordinance passed, very supportive of the ordinance throughout the process, as you were. But ultimately, Friday, they saw the draft of it and came out against it. Did that surprise you?
Not totally, but it did. I think what surprised me was how strongly they came out against it. But it didn't totally surprise me, because any ordinance was going to be like threading a needle very, very carefully. There were many council people, for example, we had a mosaic of opinions on our council. There were many people on the council who felt the ordinance went, in fact, maybe even a majority, went way too far. There were some who said, we don't need an ordinance. There were some who thought that it didn't go far enough. And I think the coalition felt that it didn't go far enough. I don't think that it was really fundamentally different from the ordinance that was supported in the town of Normal.
Gotcha. So you're trying to thread that needle. Essentially, it just became a little too watered down for the coalition to support.
It was too watered down for the coalition to support, and it had too many teeth for some who probably wouldn't have voted for it unless it was so vague and obtuse that it meant nothing.
Well, how do you better communicate with aldermen and those who are advocating for these things so that, you know, the public's time and staff time and, you know, that energy is not wasted on things that ultimately don't lead anywhere? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I don't think that this is something that didn't lead anywhere. I think this ultimately, when it became clear, but before I would have issued a proclamation or called on Chief Wheeler to deal with implementation, it had to be clear that the council was not going to act. Right. So I don't think that it was one, a waste of time, or two, that something didn't happen as a result of it. We're in the process of going to see to make sure that something happens. But when you're dealing with a sensitive subject and people change their minds at the last moment, there's not much you can do about that. There's no additional number of phone calls is going to change that. Nothing is really going to shift. Certainly, I talked to members of the coalition last week several times in many different forums, either directly or through text messages or email. I talked with, indirectly, Chief Wheeler, our legal counsel, members of the council, and ultimately, we do have something that, and also ran much of the language. Some of the language was suggested by members of the council in the proclamation, by the way. So I think that we have a proclamation that is a policy guide that does declare Bloomington's core values as a welcoming city. And that if you see a crime, regardless of whether or not your visa is expired or whatever, call the police and report it. If you've been a victim of a crime, call the police and report it. We do understand, I think, and recognize that issue. Now, whether or not it should be an ordinance and what wording in the ordinance should be there, that's, as I mentioned, and you kind of repeated that metaphor of threading the needle. The threading and the needle in this might have been possible. At this point, I don't know what that could have looked like.
And so you talked about aldermen who were maybe changing their minds or undecided until the very last minute. So you don't think that this episode reflects on your ability to build coalitions around sensitive subjects and tough issues like this?
Well, I think I don't think there are any other issues quite like this. We did get a welcoming city ordinance. We did get a police review board. And in fact, the thing that I get from people from throughout the from mayors from throughout the country is, how in the world did you get that through? And so I kind of walked them through how we managed to get that through. In many ways, there are fewer metro cities that have the kind of police review board that we have than have welcoming city ordinances. Welcoming city ordinances, is if you go online, you can find all kinds of examples. I don't want to say they're a dime a dozen to suggest that they're meaningless. I'm saying it's not hard to find cities that have welcoming city ordinances. It's very hard to find cities that have police review boards. And I think it's because we had the first that it made the proclamation that I issued yesterday have more substance. So we've had two of these. I mean, I suppose you could say, my batting average is 0.5. I don't know that that's the case. These were both very, very difficult issues to get through the council and to get support from in the community.
So yesterday, when you canceled the special session and the proclamation was issued and you issued a statement about why you were canceling the meeting, you said that you were going to be directing the police chief, or not directing, you were going to be recommending that the police chief, Clay Wheeler, develop policies and guidelines for how his officers interact with ICE as it relates to immigrants. But I do want to ask, since the police department does report to the city manager, not to the mayor, what role should the council and the mayor have in this kind of stuff, especially since the council's not really unified on this issue?
I think the council on some – whether or not you have an ordinance and its specific language, the council may not be unified. But I think that the council is unified in that they would like to see more proper training. I think that they would like, obviously, they want to promote public safety to the extent that people feel free to call the police when they are victims of a crime or they see a crime. And those are the, that's where I think we can get the nature of what is united, what brings us together. And the other thing is while technically what you said is true, that the boss of the city manager is the mayor and the city council, and the chief elected executive is the mayor. The mayor does have residual executive power. That does not include the power to hire and fire the police chief, but it certainly has, the mayor, for example, has, in Bloomington at least, the power of a veto, power of a line item veto, and also what we might call the mass media power. But I think there are quite a few resources, most of which I have chosen not to use, that are certainly at my disposal, that I certainly could use, or a future mayor could use, and that makes them the chief elected executive. So it is a delicate balance, and we do have a separation of powers for a reason.
So what happens if police come back with a policy that is status quo, as shown by past emails? A communication with ICE will be routine, low level, and without oversight by high level administrators.
I can't imagine that's going to happen.
You think there'll be some evolution in it?
Absolutely. I don't think there's any. And I think Clay Wheeler's interviews with the press yesterday, he went even further than I think that I would have expected given our conversations.
Given your conversations, when do you expect something like this to actually be developed and, as you put it, widely disseminated?
Well, I think that this isn't, it's not a specific date. This is happening today, right? I mean, this is beginning now. We will have to set a date for the police review board to begin to meet, and they may need to meet several times to kind of bounce off ideas amongst themselves and the police chief. So certainly several months, but I see this as an ongoing issue because let's face it, Bloomington and Normal are not changing. We're not a static target. Immigration is not going to stop tomorrow. Immigration isn't going to freeze. We are going to be a different community a year from now or 2 years from now or 5 years from now than we are right now. And so those are the things that we have to understand, and that this is, I see it as a continuing process. So I think, but in terms of what we will hear, I'm sure in the next several months, once the police review board comes forward, we'll begin to hear some ideas and recommendations come forth. But I would see this as a continuing process that the chief and the council and the city manager and the police review board continues to work on.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner of the city council last night approved a marketing agreement with Illinois Wesleyan University, that's your employer, to seek bids for the former Mennonite Hospital and Electrolux site on Main Street. So if you're new to town, that's the big vacant plot of land that's just north of downtown by the Thorntons there. So, Mayor, what are you hoping will happen there at that site?
I would like to see something that is the quote unquote highest and best use of the land. What does that mean, right? I mean, that's the jargon, and it could be light retail, and that's perhaps one of the targets on the first floor. Perhaps some sort of housing, apartments. One developer at one point had fairly elaborate plans for a second wave of townhouse development that would be closer to Franklin Park. Whatever the it is, we need to make sure that it is an engine of economic growth and that it is a critical anchor along our Route 66 and Main Street corridor right next to the oldest park in the city of Bloomington, and that's, of course, Franklin Park. So I have, as long as those boxes are checked, I'm open to just about anything.
And Electrolux has been gone now since 2015. The city's owned that property since 2016. Why has it taken so long to get to this point of stepping toward this agreement with Illinois Wesleyan and moving toward an RFP?
That's a very good question, to which there's only a complicated answer. First of all, I wanted it to happen. In fact, I believe Mike McCurdy asked me questions about this in 2013 and 2014 before we owned the land. I wanted everything to happen, of course, yesterday. Now, that might be a little unrealistic because I like things to happen immediately. My motto is do it now. But I was told by the previous city manager, Mr. Hales, that we would have an RFP, request for proposals, ready and out by February of 2017. So that's almost a year and a half ago. Obviously, that did not happen. When I asked, there were a variety of reasons. And then this did ultimately, some of this had to be approved. Of course, the memo of understanding had to be approved by Illinois Wesleyan University. But mostly, I would say that it's on the city. And the we need to have a stronger culture of just getting things done within the city of Bloomington. Frankly, it's an embarrassment when people have asked me. I've been talking about this for 5.5 years. We've owned it for well over 2 years. Why isn't something happening? It is something I discussed with the new city manager at length. If you're so busy you can't do it, then contract that out. It's not rocket science. You know, if we were asking somebody to do something so complicated that it would require some specialist from someplace, it'd be different. But you could get any number of firms in Chicago or Springfield or whatever, or even Peoria, to just do, maybe even in Bloomington, to do an RFP for us. And so hopefully this will happen as expeditiously as possible. That was a meeting. That was a meeting I had just before I came here to try to nudge or push things along.
When the city owns land all over downtown, most recently acquiring some parking lots formerly owned by Frontier, why aren't there more RFPs kind of floating around out there for some of these properties that you guys have?
Well, just to back up, there really are only, other than the Frontier lots that you've mentioned in downtown, the only other lot that we have that we could do an RFP on that's sort of downtown is the Coachman property. And there's another piece that we acquired, I believe it was 0.56 of an acre, maybe it was 0.96 of an acre that we acquired. And so that's now partly, or that's in a TIF. And so we wanted to see that work was done before we sent out an RFP for that project. We don't want an RFPs necessarily for the Frontier lots at this point until we see what other developments are happening. But you can park on the Frontier lots, and that's pretty clear. We're certainly moving forward in downtown with more proper signage on the properties that we do own. Again, we acquire properties for a variety of reasons. We might acquire a property so that we can do something with it ourselves. We might acquire a property like Electrolux that we, in a sense, want to flip. We want somebody else to do it, or the Coachman lot that we want to flip. So there are a variety of reasons. Again, if you really broadly define downtown, with the former Sugar Creek packing plant is the only other piece of property that we've acquired since I've been mayor, in that area. And right now that's, if you see, it's part of parking for Public Works. Eventually we will be relocating Public Works as the library will inevitably expand.
And you've talked about being aggressive from a timing perspective now moving forward. You've been a little bit unhappy with how long it's taken to get to this point. But how aggressive do you think the city should be when it comes to incentives on this project off Main Street here? How aggressive do you want to be, frankly?
Well, I would say, depending on the nature of the project, if it is a game-changing project, then I think we should be very aggressive. But by very aggressive, let's be clear, we are not talking about taking any tax money that we currently have. Any project in our economic development has to pay for itself. So right now, that lot is generating zero tax dollars for property taxes because we own most of it and Illinois Wesleyan owns, as a nonprofit, the rest of it. So any increment, let's say somebody put a $25 million project on it. I mean, that would be probably the high end. They're going to be paying a lot of property taxes. We, depending on what that is, if we judge that to be, its economic impact and spillover for the immediate area to be very substantial, then we might be willing to go a full distance and even use a TIF. We might only say, maybe 10 years of a TIF. Or maybe no TIF. If you've got a lot of retail, we'll rebate you some taxes. But the money has to be generated from your investment, Mr. Investor.
Since your last visit, Alderman Diana Howman announced that she will not be seeking re-election next spring. My colleague Eric Stock here interviewed her about that. And she just sounded frustrated, I mean, about her own lack of impact as an alderman and by what she described as a lack of leadership, even on your part. So what did you think of her comments and her reasoning behind stepping away next year?
Well, I mean, obviously that's up to her. I can't do what all of 9 aldermen tell me that I should do or want to do. And I think Diana should be applauded, for example, for being really the only alderman of the 9 who does what virtually every alderman in Normal does, and that is goes to the Illinois Municipal League, goes to the National League of Cities, has some, so they can have some broader comparative context of what they're doing in their job, right? You can't run a $215 million a year operation if you're not talking to similarly situated people and getting new ideas. And for a variety of reasons, that's just a very important thing. So I think, you know, I would applaud Alderwoman Howman for that. And I certainly have appointed her, you know, to several things, including our One Voice trip. And so certainly there are some things that I have confidence in her on. Yes, there are some things that obviously she would have wanted that I did not accommodate. I didn't agree with her on everything, obviously. Even though I appointed her, she did run against me in the last mayoral election. So I think that, you know, there are definitely going to be some differences. But you know, we work together well, I think. I do agree, though, with her that the council does need to figure out how to work together more effectively. We are not as functional as Normal, for example. Normal talks to each other. You know, Normal understands when you come to a meeting, you come there to act, and that is make decisions. That's not have been the culture long before I was even mayor on the Bloomington City Council. The previous mayor had similar kinds of issues and problems with kind of the culture on the council. And I think some of that is because of our ward system. When you've got 9 people elected from a collection of neighborhoods, nobody gets more than a few hundred votes. And they're managing they're making policy. That's different, like in Normal, where everybody has the same constituents. In Bloomington, nobody does, right? All the 9 wards are mutually exclusive, and I get everybody. So, you know, I or whoever the mayor, you know, the next mayor would be and mayor after that. So the mayor has to represent everybody and is the chief executive officer. So that is inevitably going to create some degree of tensions. But I do agree with her. I'm very frustrated with the process of the council. And that's why I recommend that they go to the Illinois Municipal League and other things.
Well, Mayor Renner, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after regular and special council meetings. Next week, Mayor Chris Koos will be in studio.
Support for GLT comes from Community Players Theater, presenting Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, a timely and timeless biblical saga set to an engaging cornucopia of musical styles. Details and tickets at communityplayers.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, safety issues for highway construction crews. Ryan Denham will have more. President Trump's nominee to the Supreme Court is Federal Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Joining us to talk about that is Illinois State University Professor of Politics and Government Tom McClure. Thanks for coming up to the studio.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
Judge Kavanaugh has a long history of legal writing on the D.C. Circuit. Some federal judges' scholarship does not shape later Supreme Court opinions. Some does. Has Judge Kavanaugh made a mark in that way?
Well, he's issued around 300 opinions. Of those opinions, around 40% are administrative law. And I think that what you can glean from that is that he is a very strong advocate of separation of powers and does not like delegation to administrative agencies unless it's express. So I think it's fair to say that he probably would be someone who would be inclined to deconstruct the administrative state. As far as other areas, I think he's got a rather balanced record. There's a few things that do point out that the conservatives would like. For instance, he's certainly a strong advocate of the Second Amendment. He certainly is a strong advocate of religious liberty. But in terms of some other matters, he's got a mixed record. So, for instance, in employment discrimination cases, there are cases that he is favorable to the employee, whereas in labor cases, he tends to be more employer-oriented.
So where is his record lacking? Where is his scholarship not really on offer? Because, as you noted, the D.C. Circuit is heavy on regulatory stuff and not some of the other issues that are present in society.
Well, the issues that I think are most important to a lot of people observing this nomination process have to do with abortion, same-sex marriage, Affordable Care Act. And I don't think that we can read a whole lot into Judge Kavanaugh's decisions to come up with where he stands on those. He had the opportunity to make a statement as to whether abortion is something that is guaranteed under the Constitution. And in that case, he went to great pains to make it clear that he was taking no position on that. He applied precedent. And one of his colleagues was very clear that she was opposed to an interpretation that abortion was guaranteed under the Constitution. There haven't been any cases concerning gay rights that he has decided, so we don't know where he stands on that. And on the Affordable Care Act, arguments were being made by both conservatives and liberals that he is not true to their position. So it's unclear where he stands on those.
Is he a potential Justice Kennedy in hiding, yet to be unveiled?
I don't expect that. What I do expect is, based on his background, based on his record, I think that he would tend to be more of a conservative moderate, not necessarily on the social issues, but he might be close to the center of the court with Justice Roberts. That's what I would predict, but again, it's hard to say until he's in office.
He has written and suggested that sitting presidents should not be subjected to the criminal code and advance the theory of the unitary executive. Is that record significant now? That came early in his career.
Well, actually, he wrote that in a Law Review article published in the Minnesota Law Review. And in that article, he recommended that Congress enacts a statute that would immunize the president from civil or criminal investigations. So it appears from that article that he's not taking a constitutional position, saying that the Constitution guarantees it. Instead, he asked the legislature to take that action.
Each justice has their own take on the Constitution that can show up in sometimes surprising ways. Justice Scalia, for instance, was big on individual rights in some criminal law areas. Are there signs Kavanaugh will stake out some non-orthodox territory like that?
Too early to tell.
The finalists for the Kennedy seat on the court came from a list compiled by the Federalist Society. By using the recommended list, conservatives are hoping to avoid the possibility of another Earl Warren, William Brennan, David Souter, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Justice Anthony Kennedy. They turned out to be more middle of the road or even liberal than the GOP had hoped. Is that the way of business going forward? Is that the vetting process, what we're going to see on both sides?
Well, for all of his faults, I think President Trump has certainly used a model that is worth emulating, which is this very transparent list of vetted jurists who could be the next Supreme Court justice. So I would hope that that's what would happen, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat. I think that the key, though, if you take a look at the list, it's not the social issues that are driving it. Instead, it appears that the Heritage Society, Heritage Foundation, and the Federalist Society are looking for judges who are more interested in an originalist type of interpretation of the Constitution and the deconstruction of the administrative state.
What will that mean going forward for cases involving corporate law and cases involving government agencies and cases that involve individual freedoms?
Well, it could go both ways. I don't think that it's necessarily a politically ideological issue on individual rights. For instance, if you take a look this last term on an immigration case, Justice Gorsuch went with the four liberals to basically say that there was a provision that was vague and found the law to be unconstitutional under the Due Process Clause. So I think that there will be victories for the right and victories for the left, depending on the cases that come before it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Tom McClure, a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University, about the Brett Kavanaugh nomination to the Supreme Court. What does Judge Kavanaugh's clerking show about him? By your clerks, you shall know him. What can we be discerned there?
He's got a very interesting record. He's had 48 law clerks. Of those 48, 25 have been women, and 13 have been of underrepresented groups. So there's a great deal of diversity. But that diversity certainly does not suggest that he has hired people who are not strong candidates. In fact, 39 of his 48 clerks have gone on to clerk for other justices of the Supreme Court. I think the only other judge that has that good of a record is Judge Merrick Garland. Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
And so he certainly is a way of training people who go to the Supreme Court. And it's interesting who's hired his clerks. There are people who are both liberal and conservatives who hire them. In other words, he's well-respected at that level.
Women's issues? Any clue there?
Women's issues. Well, if you take a look at his life, it certainly shows that he has a great deal of respect for women. He's got two daughters. He coaches one of their athletic teams. His mother was a judge. So I see in his life, it appears that he is certainly someone who is sensitive to and views women as his equal.
And his clerks, the majority have been women, right?
That is correct.
So, in a conflict between original construction of the Constitution and settled law, as in Roe v. Wade, which is going to win for him?
I think what you're going to see is he's going to take a look at the entire record and make the decision. I don't see Roe versus Wade being overturned. There, it may be chipped away. When Chief Justice Rehnquist took the helm of the court, everyone expected Miranda would be eliminated. That's not what happened. It got chipped away, but the fundamental rule still exists. I expect the same thing with the right to abortion as well as same-sex marriages.
The liberal bloc of justices, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, has generally, actually, it's worth noting, voted more in lockstep than the conservative justices, partly because until now Scalia and Kennedy had their own ideas. Is that all about to change, or is he enough of a moderate to be that centrist part that Judge Roberts is turning out to be in the absence of Kennedy?
Well, I'm not so sure that they're always in lockstep. I think Justice Breyer tends to be much more conservative on criminal procedure than the other three justices. Is that going to change? I don't know. He certainly has a personality to work with people and I think be persuasive. So it would be nice to see them work together, but I don't know that there's really a hostility that exists on a personal level, so I would expect that they would probably continue to vote the same way they've been voting.
Courts go back and forth as societal issues change. Can we really say this will be a conservative court for a generation if Justice Kavanaugh or Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed?
With the exception of same-sex marriage and abortion, I don't see his votes being appreciably different than Justice Kennedy's. I would say that there really isn't a major change that's taking place if he gets confirmed.
How does he come down on equal employment and opportunity, employment discrimination cases?
There's a couple cases that I can think of. There's one where he basically said if there is a racial basis for a transfer of an employee, that is a violation of Title VII. Another case is a supervisor's use of the N-word one time is enough to establish a racially discriminatory environment. So it appears that in employment discrimination cases that he is pro-employee.
Has the sustained campaign for conservative justices and the attention liberals have given to the same nomination issue when they've been on top changed the nature of the federal judiciary over the last 30 years to reflect the polarization in the rest of our politics?
Absolutely. The last time that I can recall that a Supreme Court justice was approved unanimously was Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia's nominations. It's hard to believe that those two justices were voted in without any opposition. It's hard to imagine that can ever happen in today's culture.
But with the appointment of more conservative and more liberal justices, do we lose the middle in the judiciary?
That's a good point. I don't think that we lose the middle in terms of the appointment of district courts, which is the trial court at the federal level. And as those judges move up through the system, then they're potential candidates for the Supreme Court. But if you take a look at the last, the way things have been going, at least at the Supreme Court level, you tend to get the extremes.
Some judicial scholars, some federal judges tend to shape Supreme Court opinions with their own scholarship. Some pretty much try to avoid that. Where has Judge Kavanaugh come down on that? Has he really had some teeth in later Supreme Court opinions due to his lower court rulings?
11 times, as a matter of fact. His opinions have been adopted by the justices of the Supreme Court. So he's had a tremendous impact, which also lends support to my argument that he's going to have a persuasive power within the court.
How long does it take a new justice to find their footing, to begin to identify themselves and to make an impact?
Well, if you take a look at Justice Gorsuch, he was full stride this first full term. He wrote more majority opinions than any other associate justice. So in my view, it's up to the justice. Gorsuch was faster than most, but it didn't take him very long at all.
What are the factors that play into that maturation?
I would think a lot of it would be experience. I would expect that if affirmed that Justice Kavanaugh would be able to get up to speed very quickly because of his vast experience in opinion writing.
You remarked that the new center of the court is likely to be Justice Roberts. He's more conservative than Kennedy. What can we expect Roberts to do now that he has the power to shape majorities in addition to assigning the person to write the opinion?
I know that people will probably disagree with my speculation here, but he's going to protect Roe versus Wade. He is going to protect Obergefell. He is not going to see those particular decisions overruled because he knows that the majority of the public supports both of those. And in terms of the legitimacy of the court, he does not want it to lose that kind of influence as an institution. The same thing that he did with the Affordable Care Act.
How deferential to public norms, societal norms, do you think Judge Kavanaugh would be if confirmed?
Well, he's more of a textualist than Justice Roberts would be. But it would probably be a factor, it would be a great factor in terms of overturning precedent, but I don't know that it would be a factor when something comes to the court for the first time.
Could Democrats really hope for any better nominee than a well-respected scholar from the establishment Bush wing of the GOP?
Well, probably not. I mean, given the 25 on the list, I guess it depends where you come. Libertarians certainly would have wanted Judge Don Willett. But as far as the other candidates go, I think that this is probably the best that the Democrats could hope for.
So how will the confirmation battle shape up? There are Democratic senators in Trump states, and there are moderate Republicans in fairly blue states. So poking around the edges of those votes, what are you forecasting?
I predict a confirmation. If you take a look at the two most vulnerable Republican senators on this issue, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, they voted for Justice Gorsuch, and I would expect that they would follow suit here. And he might even pick up some senators who are Democrats, as was the case with Justice Gorsuch. It would be the senators from West Virginia, North Dakota.
Joe Manchin, John Tester.
Right.
So what does the public need to know about the matter going forward? Why would Democrats, if it's going to be such an easy vote after all the Sturm und Drang settles down, why contest this one?
Merrick Garland. The Democrats are still stinging from the fact that Senator McConnell did not allow Merrick Garland's confirmation hearings to even begin. And so I think it's just a matter of principle that it doesn't make any difference who President Trump puts up there. They're going to fight it because they feel that they've been robbed of a Supreme Court seat.
But if they're not capable of defeating the nomination, then why not just wait until they're in the ascendancy again and say, we're ramming our choice through no matter what?
I think it's a litmus test for loyalty to the party. So whether they lose or whether they don't, they're going to go out fighting. So I think that's what's going to happen. They believe that what happened with the Republican Senate was unprecedented, which is untrue. It's happened three prior times in history where there's been no action taken on the president's nominees to the Supreme Court.
When were those, by the way?
Well, they were not in the recent centuries. One was Millard Fillmore.
Okay.
Another one was John Tyler, and then the last one was Andrew Johnson. So it was a while ago, but nevertheless, it's not unprecedented.
But those also are in times of political turmoil too. I mean, those where one party was ending and another party was being created. In the case of Fillmore, or Fillmore was a know-nothing, right?
He lost the nomination to his party at that time,
mm-hmm.
and then Franklin Pierce came in with the nomination, and they wanted to save the spot for him, and he made the appointment.
So I guess what I was going for was that it's likely to be in times of political ferment that this sort of thing happens.
I'd say that there might be some analogies, but yeah, that's when it happened before, although that wasn't really the case with John Tyler.
Democrats, though, have not traditionally paid attention to the importance of Supreme Court nominations as a campaign plank. Republicans certainly have over the last 30 years. Is it really important to use this as a mobilizing tool for the base in the fall elections?
I think Hillary Clinton did. As a matter of fact, in the debate, she said that she was going to appoint a justice who was going to overturn Citizens United. So she said that, and Trump said he was going to appoint a justice that overturns Roe versus Wade. So I think they both candidates made that an issue in their campaigns.
Tom McClure is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, serving the retirement needs of individuals with a continuum of care from independent and assisted living apartments to short and long-term skilled nursing care, all on the same comfortable campus. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. From major projects on Interstate 74 to smaller resurfacing work around Bloomington Normal, summer road construction season is officially underway. Sure, that means headaches for drivers, but it's no walk in the park for construction crews either. GLT's Ryan Denham hit the road to talk to those on the front lines and the things drivers do that put roadwork zones at risk.
Becky Slidham from Bloomington is the person you see at the start of a roadwork zone, the one directing traffic and keeping workers and drivers safe. She's a flagger. But there's another informal job title that she's bestowed upon herself.
Oh, yes. I'm the crab catcher.
Yes, in addition to putting herself in harm's way every day, the local 362 Laborers Union member has the pleasure of getting attitude from drivers upset that their commute is a few minutes longer because of road work. Another thing Becky sees? Cell phones. A lot of cell phones. Plenty of close calls, too.
And I've even had a person come about run me over. She did not stop, and coming down the highway at a fast rate of speed, and I had to get in the ditch, and she did finally stop, got her stop, and she was actually texting, and she had it on the steering wheel and continued to text after I even stopped her. I was looking at her. people sometimes don't respect they don't think it applies to them, but it does.
I caught up with Becky as she worked on a resurfacing project for Bloomington Township on Oakland Avenue last week. It's one of many projects going on around Bloomington Normal and McLean County during the summer road construction season. Those who work in the industry say now's a good time to remind drivers that safety around road construction isn't just IDOT's job or Becky's job or state police's job. It's everyone's job. And if we look at it like a job, just say our performance review would be not good. 29 people were killed in roadwork zone accidents in Illinois last year. Most of those fatalities are drivers and passengers, not the workers themselves. And still, 143 road workers died in road construction sites nationally in 2016, the most recent data available. That's according to the Federal Highway Administration. The two biggest factors, speeding and distracted driving. As a flagger, Becky gets a real close look at both. Becky's boss on last week's job site was Superintendent and Row Construction Personnel Coordinator Tad Myers from Mackinac.
Flagging is probably one of the most underestimated positions. It's usually try to keep the same people on it a lot because they are professionals at it and do a good job at it. And it's what's protecting not only the traveling public but our people to make sure they get home a safe night. So we want to make sure it's somebody that the crew trust with their backs turned to traffic.
Myers says cell phones are the major issue. That tracks with the State Farm survey from last year, showing a significant relationship between self-reported rates of cell phone use and self-reported number of crashes.
You know, and that second of distraction can get one of our people ran over and not going home that night. So it's definitely a scare.
Julie Heil from the Normal-based Heil Group does consulting work with companies on safety, continuous learning, and workplace documentation. She's recently worked with clients on driving safety. I asked Julie whether all those public safety awareness campaigns about slowing down in work zones and all those tickets issued by police, it worked. Have road work zones become objectively safer in recent years?
I would say that we were making good progress until the advent of cell phones in cars, and I think that we have lost ground.
And the 29 road work zone deaths in 2017, that's actually an improvement. There were more than 40 deaths each year in 2015 and 2016. Juan Pava leads the Illinois Department of Transportation's work zone safety program.
Having those 30 fatalities was unacceptable, and we continue to strive to have that zero number.
IDOT's work zone safety efforts have focused on four areas: education, engineering, emergency services, and enforcement. Enforcement is all those state police citations. Education are those public awareness campaigns. On the engineering side, Pava says they're looking at data and trends to make decisions rather than knee-jerk reactions.
For instance, we have increased the use of temporary rumble strips in advance of work zones. And what these are is they're strips of built-up tape or that go across the lane in advance of static or dynamic signs warning that there's something up ahead. So if someone is, for instance, maybe distracted with their kids in the back seat, they feel their vehicle vibrate slightly, and they can just look up and see that there's a sign that says, you know, there's slow stop traffic ahead, you know, pay attention.
IDOT's mantra is that work zone safety is everyone's responsibility.
We want to make sure that we all take responsibility for the safety not only of ourselves but of others out there. We have to make sure that we pay attention when we're driving.
Christina Schultz is a senior performance consultant at Heil Group, which preaches safety culture based on shared accountability and responsibility. She grew up in the car-centered world of Chicago suburbs. When she's driving, she thinks of herself as traveling through someone's workplace. She's the interloper, steering a 4,000-pound piece of heavy machinery into someone's office.
I would say first nature, right? As you mentioned, your path of travel, your destination, so easy to get caught up on where you're going and in what time frame. But you can teach yourself to broaden that peripheral vision, and I think you can teach yourself to shift those perspectives. I think that's why, you know, we would argue it's cultural.
She says that safety culture can be cultivated even in workplaces filled with cubicles and not orange cones. Companies of all types can offer defensive driving training, for example, or hold their employees accountable for dangerous distracted driving.
That really maybe sets us really up well for helping companies understand the role they can play in sending home a very strong message. We care so much about your safety transiting to and from this workplace. We are prohibiting and we are no longer tolerating, we're no longer expecting our employees to be so available to us that they will pick up a phone call, a text message, check their social media while operating a vehicle.
That State Farm survey from 2017 showed other troubling connections between cell phone use while driving and other behaviors. It found the greater number of smartphone activities drivers engaged in behind the wheel, the more likely they were to participate in other risky behaviors, like driving under the influence, racing, or failing to wear a seatbelt. Julie Heil from the Heil Group says the brain science behind distracted driving makes the dangers crystal clear. If you're driving with a handheld phone to your ear, you're as distracted or inattentive as someone 2 times the legal limit for a DUI. Even more surprisingly, Heil says driving with a hands-free device is actually twice as dangerous from a distraction standpoint as driving with a handheld device.
So we frequently will have to say to our customers,
who are very proud of themselves that they have persuaded themselves and put out some kind of a policy that says we're going to go hands-free. Our response to that is it's a kind of, you've persuaded yourself of something that seems like it's a higher standard. You've actually just put your entire fleet at twice the risk of a vehicular incident.
And there's lots of room for improvement. Illinois sees around 5,100 work zone crashes on average every year. Here's Juan Pava from IDOT.
Pay special attention to your surroundings. There may be workers that are close to the open lane. There may be equipment entering or leaving the work area, sharp curves, open holes, or change conditions that make driving a lot more difficult through the work zone. So just be responsible, put your cell phone down, slow down, and pay attention, because it does save lives.
You can track big construction projects on IDOT's website, gettingaroundillinois.com. I'm Ryan Denham.
And if you're still not convinced, the first offense penalty for speeding in a work zone is $375. If you hit a worker, you'll pay a fine of up to $10,000 and spend 14 years in prison. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.